Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
Someone is trying to frame me. You've got to help me.
But you're just too hot, Farmer.
Follow Harry Palmer. What happens to him concerns you. Yes, you. And you.
You will forget all about the Ipcress trial. You have forgotten your name.
In truth, his name is Michael Caine, and no one will forget his name. Michael Caine. He walks straight into sensational stardom in the Ipcress file as he gets right under the skin of the brash, cocky, wry-humored Harry Palmer. The soldier seconded from the army for security duties, who's never far away from a girl and always closer than close to trouble.
Now get this. I'm going to tell you until I know you're clean. And if you're not clean, I'm going to kill you.
Both these men cover the British security network, but each keeps his own counsel and his own secrets. The one on the left is Dalby of the Home Office, a passed-over major, but nothing passes him by now.
A word in your shell-like ear. If there's anything to be reported to Ross, I report it. Understand?
Yes, sir.
This is Colonel Ross of the War Office.
I want you to do a job for me.
Any choice?
Frankly, no.
She's Jean Courtney, one of the agents Harry works alongside. But whose side is she on?
You're working for Ross. He sent you here.
Don't be silly. I'm working for Dalby.
Between the kisses and the double crosses, they are all working for somebody, whilst you get the closest workover of them all as you actively share the stark, dangerous secrets of the Ipcress file. Move over for today's most sensational hypnotic meeting with suspense.
Thank you.
Now listen to me. Now listen to me. Induction of psychoneuroses by conditioned reflex under stress. Maybe that could be arguably said to be a version of Resonance Rewind. Who knows? We do actually have one celebrity contributor to this edition of Resonance Rewind, in which we are indeed looking at the Harry Saltzman production of the Sidney J. Fury-directed movie written by Len Deighton, W.H. Canaway, and James Doran. Of course, the Ipcress file. So good, I named it twice there. Phil Herdwood, welcome back to Resonance Rewind. Your thoughts, please, the Ipcress file.
Good evening. Well, apart from anything else, I think we can safely say that Michael Caine in that movie was absolutely representative of 1960s cool. Apart from anything else, I thought he is ultimately very, very cool. And what I liked about the film, and I think, you know, that isn't necessarily that apparent in the book, but what I liked about the movie was the fact that, we had the very highly polished James Bonds at around about that time. And this is almost a kind of a subverted spy thriller, isn't it, in a way? It's much more kind of, although some of the camera work is questionable, a little bit too sort of pleased with itself, I think, in some ways. A bit artsy. But I think it actually sort of is a counterpoint to the James Bond movies in the sense that there is more realism there. And there's some stuff that you couldn't get away with now, you know. I only like the birds, you know, and things like that, sort of remarks about quite sexist stuff. And, you know, it's just obviously things were different then. The past was another country. But I think it's a good yarn, put it that way. It has its flaws, I'm sure. But, you know, and the plots can sometimes, you know, lead you up blind alleys a bit. And you think, where's that going to go now? But honestly, I thought it was a great movie. And as a little postscript, I had worked some years ago with a wonderful actor who sadly is no longer with us. Hi there. we were approached by a student body to make a kind of a pastiche of the Ipcress file. And we actually had a supermarket for the entire weekend. It was closed over the weekend. And we went and did it. It was one of the Sindons, which was terrific, terrific to do. And he played the kind of the Nigel, what's his name, role. And I played the Michael Caine with the glasses. And I spoke to him just like this. And it was really in the Michael Caine mode. Not a lot of people know that. I didn't say that. But it was, you know, very much in there. So I have special memories and very fond memories of that. I never saw a cut of that film. I was very disappointed. But it was fun to do, put it that way. But yeah, well, great movie.
As Guy Dolman would say in his character of Mr. Ross, of course, Commander Ross, he was not really one for the American form of the supermarket. It was all newfangled stuff, certainly in 1965. Speaking of Americans, Jessica Burt is back with us. Now, Jessica, you have literally just finished this movie.
Yeah.
So what are your immediate... Had you ever seen it before, or is this a completely new experience for you?
So, I had never even heard of this before. But it came out the same year that my dad was born, and my mom, of course, immediately recognized Michael Caine, and she watched it with me just a bit ago. So it's a very new experience to see this, and I mean, you can't really beat like the 60s British spy films. I feel like they're excellent. They're so fun for a reason. I think it was really interesting getting introduced to a new character, a new spy, a new organization, and also a new mystery. And I was so curious about the shopping line. I was like, what is the American grocery store experience? I need to know, because I feel like if I'm in Tesco, it's the same thing. But the store they were in was so crowded, you know, they were bumping into everybody. But no, it was, I actually really enjoyed this movie. It was very fun.
A complete contrast, as we said, to the glamour and wish fulfillment of Roger Moore in Live and Let Die, which, of course, we looked at last week, as far as Resonance Rewind is concerned. Did you feel that it kind of built up the tension effectively? I mean, there we have a lead character who's very myopic, take off his glasses and everything's a blur. So he's challenged from that point of view. He's clearly in a position whereby he was a bit of a Jack the Lad when he was doing army service duty. He's got this threat of a jail sentence hanging over him. It's interesting, in the 2022 ITV version of The Ipcress Files, starring Joe Cole as the Michael Caine character, they went into that in a lot more detail, as they would, because they had 6 hours to play with. So they actually did it over a 6-week period. Yes. And Lucy Boynton took on board the sort of female lead from that. How did you connect with the character of Harry Palmer, Jessica? Because Phillips rightly sort of said that a number of things that he was saying, he just wouldn't even, it wouldn't pass the first script approval stage today, basically. You just think, whoa, where are we going with this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like par for the course of older movies. But I think just looking at it within the context it's made, I think that looking at this character, Harry Palmer versus James Bond, is really interesting, because they're both kind of like suave in their own way, and they're very good at what they do, their spy work, but I think they're very different. I think James Bond tends to be a bit more I don't know, he kind of carries himself with a different air. He's a little bit more arrogant, whereas I feel like Harry is a little bit more rebellious. He kind of doesn't seem to be on anybody's side but his own to a degree, and that gave him a bit of an air of like unpredictability, I think, and made him very interesting, because you couldn't really, and he was also just like a more playful character, I think. You know, it was funny just watching him make a paper airplane and like toss it onto somebody's desk at the office, and made him feel a bit more real of a character. And of course, yeah, the glasses, I think all of us, you know, we can understand the glasses experience. I don't know how it would work being a spy. I feel like that would be, you know, it would get a little hard if you lose your glasses. But I know, I like, and I loved his fashion too. I think they dressed him very well. I think the neutrals with the color palette that the film had were nice. I think quite a lot of like the 60s film watched it, very colorful, you know, they're very bright, a lot of pop to them. And I thought this was interesting. It was more slate grays and cream colors, and it felt very kind of industrial to it. It felt like something like a spy organization.
It certainly presented an era of London, which I suspect Philip can recall, I can recall, with parking meters.
Barely, it was only a small book.
Of course, and a range of other activities that were there. But yes, there was a grayness to it. But equally, this was also demonstrated by the range of characters we had. I mean, Nigel Green, of course, as the villainous Major Dalby. Of course, Guy Dolman, as we mentioned, playing Colonel Ross, who have this tension over clearly their background, which is, I would have said, arguably upper middle class. Yes. And then, of course, we have Michael Caine's Harry Palmer, which is very much the ordinary bloke in the street, shall we say, the Londoner who makes good. Surrounded, yeah, of course, by lots of wonderful character folk. Gordon Jackson, who would, of course, go on to be Cowley in a series called The Professionals, as well as Mr. Hudson in Upstairs Downstairs, playing Jock Tarswell. The CIA agent, who again has an unfortunate end, Thomas Baptiste, who plays Barney. And indeed, you know, Sue Lloyd as Jean Courtney. And perhaps one of my sort of honourable mentions for favourite characters, the character of Alice, played by Frieda Bamford, who's basically keeps the office going and sorted through on that basis alone. We talk about favourite moments. Jessica, did you have any favourite moments you want to share with us before we go back to Philip?
I think some of the twists, I think any time that there was like on the train at the beginning, when you find out what's happened with the switch with the people, I thought that was like immediately, it's like, oh, it's very sinister right off the bat. And then I think the interactions between Harry and, I can't remember, I'm so bad with character names, the leading lady.
Courtney.
Thank you, Courtney. I thought Courtney, she was great. And I thought that their conversations, at least, like, I thought she's very intellectual. And I thought it was interesting hearing them talk. I think that those were great scenes. And the one in the kind of the industrial area after collecting the guy in the briefcase of money when he had the little machine gun from that time period. It was just, I thought, like a very dramatic scene. It kind of felt like some of the spy films I'm used to with a lot of the action. Because I think this one had some action, but it was like quite a lot. It was figuring things out and clandestine meetings and things like that. I thought the meeting watching the show was great. I thought that was funny when he had like the number written on the paper that gave him a clue as to their meeting spot. I thought that was fun. I thought it was a nice break from some of like the crashing Marvel movies nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of subtleties in this, and it almost takes time to warm up. I remember seeing it as a teenager thinking, oh, this is a dull movie. I mean, I've never seen this on the big screen, but watching it on television, it just seemed to take a long time to work through. And for a considerable period of time, I was never really a fan of the spy genre, which encompassed the slow bills, the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy scenario. But then, actually, I think with advancing years, perhaps, I've suddenly begun to appreciate the line of things. And of course, there is that major twist where we go into brainwashing and the whole essence of the spy.
Yes.
I mean, which, you know, connects within that. Philip, the other Bond link is very much produced by the music of John Barry, which I think here is an exemplary score once again.
As always with John Barry. I was going to say as well, you're talking about the brainwashing. I mean, that, you know, is kind of a little bit improbable for my money, really. You know, and the fact that he said, I'm resisting, and then, oh, I'm so tired, you know, and then eventually gives in. And then, of course, the little twist, you know, he's about to kind of shoot the traitor now, you know, and then he just happens to, you know, he bashed his hand against
used the pain of the nail to effectively,
and the pain reminded him of his conditioning, didn't it? And that's right. And then all of a sudden he snaps out of it. It's sort of, oh gosh, you know, one of those Deus Ex Machina kind of moments, you know, just happened to happen, which is just at the right time. But anyway, but I mean, apart from anything else, it was, I think, you know, it really is a piece in time, isn't it? It's so representative of the 60s. I thought Michael Caine himself in his, what, second outing on
pretty
screen?
Much so. He'd worked with Nigel Green, of course, before on the movie Zulu.
Yes, he did, of course. Yes, that's right. When it was, he was meant to be playing an officer. Go and get the Beaufort scan over there and stop those Swazis coming in this direction. And it was, yes, sure. But, you know, he looked very good in the saddle, I must say, in Zulu. But, you know, his second movie, and he was so assured in that, so comfortable in the role. I mean, he just inhabited that role for that time, I thought. As a performance, it was one of his best.
You mentioned one of your connections, of course, with respect to presumably Jeremy Sinden or possibly...
Jeremy, not Mark. It was Jeremy.
Not Mark, exactly. So there we are. But there was, of course, another more explicit connection because, of course, your first movie, I believe, or one of your first movies, if we exclude Year of the French, was indeed Educating Rita, in which you played Tiger. And, of course, the lead actor in Educating Rita was indeed Sir Michael Caine.
Yes, indeed it was. Yes, yes. I had the great good fortune to be able to play in that film. And he was delightful and very, very funny. Lots of good jokes and he was very good company, I must say. And we were all very aware of the fact that he was a big star. You know, Julie Waters was, you know, I was one particular scene that was just a two-hander between the two of them. And I said to Julie Waters afterwards, I was watching, you know, and I said, my God, you two were playing up a storm there. You know, she said, thank you very much. and he said, well, that's what you do. You do. That's what you do. You know, there was a lovely aside. Actually, I must just tell you a little tiny little kind of a memory from that movie where it was shot in Dublin, actually, not in the UK for tax purposes. And it was shot at Trinity College Dublin, which is right in the centre of Dublin City.
Which is where Jessica is just on her MA, of course.
As you well know. And just literally outside the main gate. There's a, across the little road, there used to be, I don't know if it's still there, an old-fashioned tobacconist. And it's a wonderful oldie-worldie tobacconist shop. Well, Michael Caine said, and he had a beard by this time in the movie, and he said to the first assistant director, he said, I'm going to go off and buy myself some more cigars. So he walked across out of the college into the street in his, you know, Harris tweed jacket and the beard and all the rest of it. He walked into the tobacconist and he got his cigars. Meanwhile, I used to smoke small cigars at that time. And I sort of remembered, I could do with some cigars as well. So I kind of walked a little bit behind him, a minute or two behind him. And I walked up, by which time he just walked out of the shop and he said, I'll see you back there. So I walk into the shop and the tobacconist, a very old-fashioned Dublin fellow, said, he said to me, excuse me. I said, yeah. He said, was that Michael Caine? And I said, yeah. And he said, yeah, I thought so. What would you like? And it was just dealt with as quick as not. Oh my God, that was Michael Caine. You know, it was done. It was sort of just so casual. So yeah, just wanted to get that right in my head. That was Michael Caine.
Perfectly okay. Lots of lovely lines in this particular aspect. Major Dolby, of course, with the line, according to Central Clearinghouse, this operation was timed to start at 2:25. You started at 2:35. That's not good enough. Very much a tradition of the British effectiveness and the importance of timekeeping and working on the timekeeping. Again, it could be said we could actually address that whole notion to our French correspondent, singer-songwriter Victoria Simmons, who's just connecting to audio now. We're having all manner of fun things on that particular basis. Victoria, I believe you said you had a number of issues about this particular movie. So would you like to take us through how you've seen it? Again, I suspect, like Jessica, this was a complete first-time experience for yourself.
It was. Yeah, I think I watched it in like three sections because I got bored. I thought it was so flat. I don't know if anybody else has described it as flat, but yeah, there we go. I thought there's like the story and probably the acting all sort of ended up being flat, and then it was over and you're like, oh, right, okay.
I mean, it's interesting because that certainly, as a teenager, was my first experience of it. But it did seem to effectively be, it was a slow burn, I think, in terms of that. It's not a Bond film, as we said quite clearly. It doesn't work on that premise. But did you have any favourite moments, Victoria? We're just going through the favourite moment line as you take us on a little tour for the benefit of the listener here through some of the wonderful...
Horticultural adventure we're having.
Of France, here. Exactly.
It's a farmer's market. So I'm having to stand well away from any music. I liked the woman that was in it, sort of being a double agent, almost a triple agent, which pretty much was one of the only things that was interesting.
I thought you might have gone for the champignon mushrooms, of course, the evidence of, again, a spy who's not only short-sighted, but also is a good cook as well. So, again, another lovely character trait that we had there. And, of course, Sue Lloyd, loved friend, of course, of another one of our great colleagues on the shows, Annette Andre. Sue sadly passed away a few years ago now. Jessica, what about you shared your favourite moments. Philip, did you have any favourite moments?
Me? Well, not really, no. I mean, I just liked the overall feel of the whole film, I must say. And I thought it was, I just liked its stylishness. And it's very much its sense of the era. That's what really appealed to me as much as anything else. Beautifully dressed. I thought it was consummately acted. Very much a piece of its time. So I can't really say there were any particular favourite moments. I think just Michael Caine's presence and the fact that he was almost setting himself up for kind of impressions even at that time, I think.
Well, his name was Michael Caine, and we needed to obviously relate to that. Okay, Jessica, let's talk characters then. Anybody that stands out to you in terms of either honourable mentions, as I've already mentioned, one of the receptionists who seemed to have a permanent cigarette upon her lips, basically.
Yes. My mom noticed that too.
not the best sort of for health versions, but anybody who sort of you thought, yeah, let's go for that. They were worth noting. Perhaps Gordon Jackson, of course, as Jock, who decodes the whole notion or comes to the conclusion of what the Ipcress file is all about in the first place.
I really liked Courtney. I thought from her introduction, she was great. How, you know, we have that like scene where pulling out the gun and who is on the other side, and then it's her with the gun. And I think also like her clothing was so elegant. I think she had the most colorful outfits that we really saw. And it was great. I think her character was just very interesting, figuring out her motivations and who she kind of is. I thought she was just the most intriguing one. But I thought Dolby, the double crossing was fantastic. I thought the twists with Dolby were great.
Yeah. Interesting enough, one of the reviews on IMDb, a nice old spy film where both sides are tough and smart. And the notion that in the 1960s, Albania had a similar reputation that North Korea has today. I mean, it was intriguing watching the remake of The Ipcress File on ITV, because then it was very much, or is now, a period piece. This movie was obviously shot to be a contemporary movie and to be a contemporary spy movie. Probably the sequel, of course, which was, in cinematic terms, Funeral in Berlin, was probably a little bit more realistic. Victoria, any characters stood out for yourself, or are you sort of just still getting over the brainwashing sequence?
Well, actually, an honourable mention to whoever came up with the font for when they actually see Ipcress. I thought that was actually something that really stood out to you, and you could actually see exactly what was going on. But that's my honorable mention. But I really did like the cop that died instead of Michael Caine, because it was a moment when you went, oh no. So I guess that would be my favorite.
Yes, an induction of a psychoneuroses by conditioned reflex under stress. Although you could also say the Ipcress, which was on the tape itself. Analog tape, of course, which was way before the experience of many folk born in the 21st century. Favourite characters for yourself, Philip?
Me? Well, yes. I mean, I always liked, what's his face, Nigel?
Dolman. His
name. Yes, and, yes, I liked him. I liked him. Radcliffe, of course, I thought was excellent.
Nigel Green as Major Nigel Dolby, Green. Of course, and sorry, Guy yes. Dolman as Colonel Ross from that point of view. Yeah. Dr. Radcliffe,
not,
of course.
Not Major Dolby in stereo, which was something you could...
You could, but we won't. And Aubrey Richards, of course, as Dr. Radcliffe, who clearly falls prey just simply because he's getting a train up to Nottingham. And on that basis alone, he ends up actually being exchanged, ultimately, as we know, as damaged goods, thanks to Blue Jay, of course, played by Frank Gatliff.
Interesting, Blue Jay, House Martin. We've got some interesting kind of bird names going on there.
Very much so. Part and parcel of the spy ether and the line within that. And we've already mentioned Freda Bamford as far as the non-stop cigarette-smoking Alice and that kind of routine. I'll throw in also David Glover as Chico, or Chilcot Oaks, who's probably the closest thing we have in this movie to being an allegory for Q, in the Bond series, because Chilcot Oaks is obviously the man who plays around with the equipment and provides the spy details and the lines within that. But we come to scores. I mean, anything else, Philip, you'd like to raise about the Ipcress File at present? I mean, as a fan of the movie, as somebody who's obviously worked with Michael Caine and connected on that sort of basis, were you tempted when you were working with him on Educated Greeter to say, Michael, do you ever fancy doing some more? Because, of course, he did, I think, four movies as Harry Palmer. We have Funeral in Berlin.
He did reprise it. Yes, he did reprise it, didn't he, later on?
Indeed, yeah. and one in the 1990s. So he's still working through that process. Any other thoughts you'd like to add? Read the text.
I couldn't, regarding the text itself, are you saying? Sorry.
I mean, in an era where we've just seen allegedly a former Russian general effectively assassinated, in an era where we actually
now you've got to be so careful. I mean, who could possibly have that suspicion? I mean, you know,
does it still
Bull's accidents? Yes, of course.
Does it still connect in terms of the Cold War, which was very much at its heart here? Are we still referring to it in the 2020s?
I think in those days, any of that kind of, that sort of spy stuff was kind of skirting around the edges of what has now become a very sinister game. Spying and espionage and all the rest is a much more dangerous and more sinister game, I think, nowadays, where then I think it was more of a sort of an intellectual exercise, wasn't it? Sort of outwitting the, you know, cats and mouse kind of games going on. But I think it's rather more horrible than that now, really.
Or people would actually meet in the park to actually be part of a very small audience listening to a martial music band playing the Thin Red Line.
Precisely so. Precisely,
and then wrecking so. The wonderment of Carmen from Mozart as well, or in Marriage of Figaro from Mozart. Okay, Jessica, your score then for, and indeed you can give your mum the score as well from that point of view, we can have a joint Bertis score from that point of view, for the Ipcress file.
So I think an 8. I think the score my mom would support. We were invested in this film. And I think some of the strong points are the score was excellent, as we mentioned. I thought it was great at building the suspense and setting the scene. I thought that the setting and the color palette was amazing. And I'm also just like a sucker for the brainwashing plots, because I think it's very Mad Mod, isn't it? I think that there's like, you know, it always reminds me of that that classic like 60s kind of British, like the mind control. I think it's fun. It's just fun, you know?
Yeah.
And I think taking on those aspects, it's a wonderful sort of precursor for what we'll be going to consider next week, where we actually move back to the village of Port Merion, of course, the location of Port Merion, back to the village with Jessica, your favourites. The Rovers will be there. And we have even more brainwashing over a political sequence in which Patrick McGoohan will actually be marching into view as number 6, effectively fighting for his rights to be in a free-for-all. But enough of such stuff. Philip, what's your score out of 10 for the Ipcress file?
I think bearing in mind its time and its place, I think I'd give it a 9. I think it was iconic, and it still remains iconic to this day. And it's a great representation of what the 60s were doing, really. Was it, I can't remember when it came, but was it 65?
65.
I'd give it a 9 for sure. I agree with Jessica that the colour palette and the look and the styling of it all was absolutely fantastic. And it was just that moment in time, which I really liked very much indeed. I wish I'd been there in the 60s.
But you were, Philip. You were, as a child.
If you can remember the 60s, you weren't there.
Well, there you are. Interesting enough, again, I haven't seen this in the cinema. I have seen it on television. I think you need to rewatch it in many ways to appreciate the layers that come through. First time around, I might have given it a 6. Now, of course, I'm going to go 8.5. Victoria, where are you positioning yourself? And she will unmute herself. She hasn't been brainwashed. The whole thing will actually work.
I have been brainwashed. There was music, so I stopped. No, I'd give it a 5. But what I think, if it had been made shorter in certain areas and focused a tad more on the brainwashing, then it would go 6.
Hmm. I mean, interesting, because it's a relatively short movie. There's a lot of nuances in terms of looking through windows, looking through peering through windows, seeing that things are not as they seem and so on. And I think that was very well handled by Sidney J. Fury, who, again, worked well. And, of course, we haven't mentioned the Bond connection, the most explicit Bond connection. This was very much a solo production by Harry Saltzman, who, together with Cubby Broccoli, were behind the majority of the Bonds, well, all of the Bonds of the 60s, and indeed up until The Man with the Golden Gun, when Saltzman effectively decided, no, James Bond was a dying franchise, it's time to actually sell up and leave. And it's interesting that it's, I think, the Saltzman estate that effectively were responsible for the 6 episodes of the Ipcress file, which were produced in 2022 by ITV. And again, one which is set in the 60s, gives a completely different spin in terms of what the brainwashing is about and how it connects together, and it's a lot more global. But in a strange way, it seems to work. So clearly the original text by
Len Dayton,
Len Dayton still continues to work on that basis.
Absolutely. Len Dayton, didn't he go to Harry Saltzman and say, look, I've got these books, would you like them? I think that was the kind of tenor of it, really. And I think they were, as you say, the appetite was there. They thought that perhaps Bond was a dying franchise and it was time to then to do something very different and of its time, certainly.
Indeed. As a wisecracking spy investigating the kidnapping and brainwashing of British scientists while dealing with the constraints of his agency's bureaucracy. And I will actually note that that is something, sadly, which we have still not lost in the 21st century, as many higher educational establishments will admit if they're really pushed. Bureaucracy upon bureaucracy upon bureaucracy. But so it goes.
And not a lot of people know that.
Indeed so. For now, that has been the Ipcress File. We will be listening to more of the exquisite soundtrack of John Barry after we've had that Marshall Thin Red Line. And then John Barry will take us through for the remaining part of the whole thing. But to Philip Hurdwood, co-star with Sir Michael Caine, of course, in Educating Rita, and indeed writer and producer extraordinaire, and a voiceover artist. To Jessica Burtis, to Victoria Simmons, huge thanks. And to Sarah Huntley, well, hopefully you get safely back to us from the train that you're currently stuck on. So that's all we can say. Actually, it's not all we can say. We can, before we head off to next week, and The Prisoner, and Free For All, go out with either two things. We could say, keep on resonating, or be seeing you.